My castaway this week is a comedian. Born and brought up in South London, he began his career at Tooting Employment Office. Undeterred, perhaps inspired by such surroundings, he pursued his ambition to make people laugh and eventually became a stand-up comic at London's Comedy Store. From there, he graduated into radio and television. He now has his own series on Channel 4, has appeared on Radio 4's I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue and Just a Minute, and is part of the regular team on BBC Two's Have I Got News for You. He once said that watching clowns at a circus when he was 3 years old decided him on his career. I had, he says, no idea that adults could behave like that. He is Paul Merton. So you've wanted to make people laugh as long as you can remember, have you, Paul?
Yes. I can't remember a time when I didn't. When I was 3 or 4 years old, my games that I played on my own consisted of performing to an audience, an invisible audience. You know, my mother tells me, I can't really remember it, but when I was about 2 years old, she saw me in front of the television with a Joe Loss Orchestra was playing, and I was standing there with knitting needles sort of conducting along, you know.
And you used to practice your own autograph then?
Yes, I thought that was something that everybody did until a few weeks ago.
But who made you laugh as a child? I mean, on the television or whatever?
Well, I had a great sort of thirst for it all, really. So I, you know, I would, if the BBC was rebroadcasting some Hancock or something, I had a little tape recorder, long before cassette recorders, and put the microphone up against the speaker on the radio and listen to that. Goon shows, Round the Horn, all that kind of stuff on radio. And television, it would be Arthur Haynes, I can remember watching and enjoying. Films, it'd be the Marx Brothers, or going back earlier to Chaplin. I was sort of trying to absorb everything, really, you know.
But I was going to ask you specifically about Tony Hancock, because there is a resemblance. I don't know if people have said this before,
yes.
But that lugubrious, kind of rather morose style.
Possibly, yes. But I don't sort of, he's just one of many people, really. It has been mentioned before, and I sort of poo-poo the suggestion, really.
Because there was a description of you in Time Out not long ago, which is fairly unflattering, but you won't mind if I do.
No, well, I would never read Time Out, so it would be a surprise to me.
But it could have been written about Hancock, funny enough. It says, he has a deadpan demeanour accentuated by a hangdog expression, slouching posture and prematurely pot-bellied physique. I mean, rings a bell, huh?
Yes, I suppose so. Yes, I suppose there are similarities there, yes, but I have no intention of going to Australia.
But the same article says that you make Ken Livingstone sound animated. But you're not like that. You're not like that in real life. That's
no.
An interesting thing. You're not morose and unsmiling. You're not the same.
Well, I think Hancock probably was like that in real life. That's one of the differences.
But it's an act, then, is it? It's rather slightly
aggressive. Yes, it's a performance persona.
So how did you stumble upon it then? Why did you decide that actually not being very forthcoming was...
Well, I always had this thing. I never particularly liked comedians who laugh at their own jokes, you know. I sort of... If the loudest laugh's coming from the comic, then something's gone wrong somewhere, you know. One of the first things I did at the Comedy Store was this sketch about a policeman taking an hallucinogenic drug. And he starts off in a very policeman-like manner. I was patrolling along the road on October the 27th. And I get 20 seconds of that. Then he reveals he's been given a hallucinogenic drug disguised as a Smartie. Then he carries on to describe his hallucination in the same deadpan way, while sitting aboard an intergalactic spacecraft and all that kind of thing. And that worked very well, because it was the morose policeman in court being very much a sort of stereotypical policeman, really, but describing these fantastic things about meeting Marilyn Monroe on top of a bus shelter. And it worked very well. It was a combination of the fantastic allied with the very straight, deadpan, down-to-earth delivery.
So what's the first record you're going to play on this desert island?
It's a song called Spreading, played by the Kronos Quartet. It's a bunch of Western musicians working with African composers. And it's rather cheery and uplifting, I think.
Yeah.
Spreading, played by the Kronos Quartet. Now, Paul Merton, we need the inside story on Have I Got News For You. How much is it ad-libbed? How much is it over-recorded? Is it heavily edited?
Well, what happens is it's recorded the night before it goes out. So it's recorded on a Thursday. Now, the stuff that Angus does is he doesn't like people to know, so it's on auto-cue, which he works with the producer from Monday onwards, writing all those links, and they're doing all the kind of heavy work on it. And finding the questions and bits of film and all that sort of stuff. And myself and Ian go in on a Thursday afternoon, early evening, about 5:30. We're there to about 8:30, and then that's it, we're finished.
But have you spent all week looking at possible captions or headlines? You know, you've got your mind working at it all week, trying to think up
well,
a funny
line. Well, yes, just as much as you can afford to do about going potty, you know, about looking at all the tabloids. And you get a kind of instinct for it after a while. I remember a couple of years ago there was a story, Man Sleeps With Pet Pig, and how he shared the bed with this pig, and the wife said, it's either me or the pig. So, you know, she left, and he carried on with the pig. And you sort of read that, and you think, oh, that'll come up.
But are there lots of jokes afterwards that you tried to make that didn't quite work, and you think, for him to say, cut that out?
Yes, inevitably. I mean, we only record about 45 minutes worth, so if it's not a good show in there somewhere, I mean, and also with the nature of this thing, because a lot of it is ad-lib stuff, there is a finite period on it. If you haven't got anything in 45 minutes, you're not going to get it in an hour and a half because your energy goes down and you're not just reciting lines. You know, you're trying to find fresh stuff.
But you make it sound, all of it, as if it's really not very difficult. But nobody's funny by accident. It takes quite a lot of hard work.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's the thing I can do on that is based on the fact I've been performing for about 10 years and improvising since about 85. So I'm in the habit of saying things off the top of my head and not being thrown if something doesn't work.
And you get the non-comic guest,
yes.
You get the politician.
Yes.
How much hard work is that to keep him in play?
They generally fall into two camps. Either they don't say anything at all and they're just frozen by the whole thing, and you're just anything they say which you can turn into a joke or take on somewhere will help it, you know. And other times they talk non-stop and none of it's any good. So whenever you watch it and you just see one of the fourth member of the panel just smiling at everybody else's joke and saying nothing, it's either because they didn't say anything at all or they spoke for hours and none of it was any good.
Let's have some more music.
Record number two is a song from a musical called Billy that was staged about 1973, starring Michael Crawford, around about the time he was having his big hit with Some Mothers Do Have 'Em. Billy Lie was a book that I loved because it was basically the kind of thing that I was going through, this boy, in his case living in the north, who wanted to be a comedian or wanted to write for comedians and didn't know how to do it and lived in this kind of Walter Mitty dream world where all these kind of things happened. And I went to see it because I liked the book and it was just wonderful. It was a brilliant night out. It kind of fed all my egotistical thoughts about what a life in show business would be, which was basically stand on a stage when everybody just says, we love you and adore you. You know, when you're sort of 14, 15 years old, that's a very attractive lifestyle. You know, of course it's not like that, but that's how it fed all my illusions about it at the time.
In a perfect world I would wave my hand and everyone would understand the things that make me me. In a perfect world I would wave my hand and have three girls at my command, and this is how they'd be. Clouds and seas are red.
Michael Crawford, Diana Quick, Gay Soper, and Elaine Page singing Billy. So you say, Paul, that you identified with Billy Lyre, who I seem to recall sat in the lavatory most of the time, ripping up brochures that he hadn't delivered somewhere, trying to stuff them down the
pan. Yes, for a firm of funeral directors. I think it was calendars, I think it was, that he was meant to deliver.
Christmas calendars.
Yes. From a...
But was life similarly so exciting at Tooting Employment Office for you?
Well, it was one of those things. When I left school, I mean, how do you sort of, you know, careers officers would say to you, well, what do you want to do? You know, how can you say, oh, I want to be a comedian? And, you know, they won't say, well, all right, we'll get you to pick you up with Harry Worth and Petula Clark's show in Eastbourne. I mean, it doesn't work like that. So I never told anybody what I wanted to do because the reaction would be, well, they would laugh, but it's sort of laugh, the wrong kind of laugh.
Didn't your friends know?
No, they didn't really. No, around about this time, it was all a little bit upsetting. Although it turned out all right in the end, I got sent to Coventry by everybody I knew at school, which was about sort of five or six people that I was friendly with. And of course, if you're sent to Coventry, you don't know why, because nobody's speaking to you. And so there was a sort of period of about sort of 7 or 8 months at school where I fell in with some other people, but they weren't really sort of friends or whatever. But through that, I then met John Irwin, the person I write the TV shows that were scripted with, and he was at the same school, so that was great. So that was the plus side of it all. But for a while, there was an awful lot of loneliness, really, you know. And
you were a naturally shy person.
Yes, I think that's quite. I think that's true of a lot of performers. I think, particularly sort of comic performers.
What about in class, though? I mean, were you imaginative in English lessons, and were you writing well even then?
My academic career peaked when I was about 8 years old. I had a teacher who was a very good teacher called Mrs. Gately, who I'm sure is no longer, might still be alive, but this was a long time ago now. And I was very good at English with her, and I was so good that I was taking other kids in the class were reading lessons and things like that, you know, and being generally very clever in a rather sickening way, probably. But then we had the summer holidays, and the teacher changed, and I got this nun who had a very strange sort of view of what you could and couldn't write. And we had something like the essay was what we did for our school holidays, our summer holidays or whatever. And so, you know, me and my family went to Littlehampton. It was very good. It was very nice. A spaceship landed. I got on the spaceship and I went to the moon. It was very cold. And then something else happened, you know. And she sort of castigated me in front of the entire class because she said, this didn't happen. You can't write something that's untrue, you know, right, let's say. And so she read this essay out, and then, you know, the other kids then started to write in the same vein. We were suddenly thinking, oh, you know, why are we writing about sort of buckets and spades when we can write about spaceships or dinosaurs or whatever it is? And 2 or 3 weeks later, she again sort of made me stand up in front of the rest of the class and blamed me for this new trend that had been established. And it just seemed to me so wrong-headed, but when you're 8 years old and there's a nun telling you that everything that feels right for you is totally wrong, then that's a bit disturbing.
However, you did end up your education with a bit more than the CSE in woodwork that you've put about.
Metalwork. I did get ungraded metalwork. Ungraded.
But you got an English A-level as well.
Yes. So I got a couple of A-levels at the end of it.
Next record.
Next record is rather shamefaced, really. I picked a Beatles song because I used to really like the Beatles a great deal and still do, although I don't really play their records anymore. And I thought, well, do I want to take something that I've heard over and over again? And I thought, well, I must have one Beatles song. And so if it's one Beatles song, I suppose it's got to be A Day in the Life. But I haven't played it for years, and I don't suppose I'd play it that much on the island, but it'd feel odd if I didn't have it, really.
I saw the photograph. He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. Face before, nobody was really sure he was from the house. to look. Having read the
The Beatles and A Day in the Life. So when did you pluck up the courage to leave Tooting Employment Office?
Well, I...
You were there for years.
Well, I was there for about 2.5 years. You make it sound like a life sentence. I think it was good fun. I enjoyed it. I was the... Part of my duties involved the New Towns scheme, which was this scheme started up after the Second World War, which basically the idea is people who lived in bad houses in London could go to Milton Keynes or Basildon or Bracknell and all these places. And I used to get this hilarious newsletter from Milton Keynes, the Milton Keynes Bulletin. This is round about all the time with the concrete cows and stuff. You remember that story where they built a herd of concrete cows in a field, and then somebody said, well, why, you know, these cows all had were made out of bits of builder's rubble, so they had all sort of square jaws and, you know, looked as if they'd been in car accidents. And the spokesman said, yes, but if you're passing overhead in a plane, it looks like a real herd. And they had a concrete milk maid on a concrete stool and all this kind of stuff. And all this kind of hilarious thing. The people would come in to me and say, I want to go and live in Milton Keynes. And I'd have to say, well...
You do know the cows are made of concrete.
Yeah. So I'd always send them along first of all. And the deal was, if they could get a job there, and this was like, you know, less than a million unemployed, then they all could also get a house. So it was quite a good scheme. So I wasn't ever involved in that kind of work where I was saying, well, why haven't you worked for 3 years? You know, and they say, well, I've got a bad back. And I said, well, I know, it's terrible, isn't it? Have you tried one of them cushions? I had, you know, I was useless at all that kind of sort of...
You enjoyed life at the employment office?
Yes, for a certain... But I also thought, well, if I don't leave now, or roundabout now, then I'll be here forever.
But now was an auspicious day, wasn't it?
Hmm. Well, I thought, yes, I left on... I waited till February the 29th, just so I wouldn't forget the date that I left, 1980. And it was still a couple of years after that before I actually got the nerve to do what I wanted to do, to try it out, because the big fear was, well, supposing I can't do it, suppose I'm not really good at it.
But if you didn't leap, you wouldn't
then land. I would never know, yeah. You know. So one night in April 82, I found myself at the Comedy Store above a strip club in Soho at 1:30 in the morning, walking onto a stage in front of a bunch of drunk people. You know, and
this is kind of London's answer to Glasgow Empire, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, that's not a bad comparison. Yes, it was at that time the closest you would get to, except that you didn't, in Glasgow, you would get a certain amount of credence if you were from Glasgow. In London, it didn't matter, you know, whether you lived in Stepney Green all your life or whatever. You know, they were going to get you if they could smell blood.
But as far as your profession was concerned, your trade, if you like, if you could do it there, you could do it anywhere. That was the thought.
Yes, and also I was very lucky in that the second one I did there was this policeman on the drug thing I mentioned earlier, and it went really well. And I didn't have an act, and I didn't really know what I was doing. But this one night, the second or third time I ever did it, every dream had come true. And I walked all the way home, and I was living in a bedsit in Streatham on a cloud of euphoria. And that got me through every single, of which there were many, sort of bad gig after that, you know, because I didn't know what I was doing. But I was lucky to get that encouragement early on, and that kept me going over the next sort of 18 months of, you know, just dying the whole time.
Next record.
Next record. Now, I thought that I should have something that is very soothing, something that I would go to sleep listening to late at night on this desert island. So it's an instrumental track by a group called REM, and it's called Endgame.
REM and Endgame. Your career has been rather dogged by disaster, hasn't it, Paul?
Mm. Checkered, yes, definitely.
We'll start with 1986, performing on the Fringe in Edinburgh, mugged in the Lothian Road.
Yes, that's right. Somebody's put up posters for their show, not my show, and I, you know, looking for a hand. And so I sort of volunteered, and so there we were, sort of midnight, putting up these posters, and these sort of three guys came around the corner, luckily wearing soft shoes, who sort of just looked for trouble, and I sort of said the wrong thing at the wrong time or whatever, and this guy came vaulting over a sort of barricade at me and kicked me in the head, and I was, you know, it was dreadful, and I was had to go to hospital, and I was badly shaken and stuff.
And then a year later, 1987, you were in hospital again.
Yeah, well, I didn't think I'd really done the disastrous thing enough, really. I thought, because it'd been sort of motivated by other people who stopped just when it was getting interesting. So the next year, I opened a sort of one-man show, the first time I did that up there, and went out and played football with a bunch of comedians the next day, which is a sort of tradition up there. It's about as interesting as watching a bunch of footballers telling jokes, but nevertheless, we gave it a go. And I just sort of fell over, I think I just sort of fell over the end of my trouser leg or something like that, because I was running along, and suddenly my feet were where my head had been, and there was this crack, very loud, sort of, you know, bone breaking. And it was a, you know, a very bad break, and so that was the end of the show for that week.
But you'd had rave reviews.
Yes, I had very good reviews, probably the best reviews I've ever had, really, based on the one night I had done. And I was in hospital for about 3 or 4 days with a broken leg. And then I got this very bad pain in my side, and it turned out to be a thing called a pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot, which sort of forms sometimes after sort of a breakage. And it's all very sort of life-threatening, really, and the blood clot can go, you know, brain, heart or lungs, and it went to my lung, luckily. If it goes to the brain or heart, it's sort of, you know, that's it, really.
So then you got hepatitis.
No, I got hepatitis A while I was in hospital as well.
Just I'm sorry to laugh.
I know, and it was sort of, it didn't really matter that I got hepatitis A, because it sort of, they said, oh, well, I think you just got that from the hospital food, the doctor's opinion was, but it was a horrendous time.
But what that meant was that you were, what, 29 years old?
Just 30, yeah.
Just got your first big break,
yeah.
And then suddenly everything's in tatters around you.
Yeah.
Something's knocked out of you.
Yeah.
I mean, do you feel a bit jinxed? Do you feel a bit...
No, I don't think so, no. I mean, it was, you know, it was just desperately unlucky. But again, it's like one of those things of trying to find something positive out of a terribly depressing experience.
And you got quite depressed. I mean, do you... Is there a dark side, a black side to your personality? Do you have to work quite hard?
I don't think so. No, I don't know. I don't have to sort of think. Oh, I don't have sort of mood swings or whatever. You know, I mean, it was a depressing experience. The one thing that it gave me was time to think, really, in hospital, because if you're that ill, there's not much else you can do. And so I kind of sort of attempted to plot my future career from that point, and thought, well, once I recover from this in a few months' time, then I shall start making strenuous efforts to get my own television show. That stemmed from there.
It's a story of enormous determination, though, this.
Yes.
I mean, there you are, lying in Edinburgh, and
yes,
frankly, not a lot going for you.
No.
I mean, a lot going against you,
yes,
actually, and also not much of a career under your belt, and yet still you think you're going to make it.
Yes. Well, that was always because I always had that drive from an early age, but what I didn't have at an early age was the confidence, you know, to do it, because of that thing about, well, supposing it doesn't work, and, you know, and all that kind of thing. But yes, it was...
It is a tremendously strong belief in yourself, isn't it?
But yes, it was there at the heart of it all, deep down, a sort of determination to get where I wanted to get.
Record number five.
Well, record number five was Summer Samba, it's called. This was a tape that somebody bought me while I was in hospital, and it's just one of those songs I played, and I liked it, and I just played it all the time, you know, for several months. So I suppose I've picked it just if I need reminding of that terrible time in Edinburgh.
Someone to hold me tight, that would be very nice. Someone to love me right, that would be very nice. Someone to understand, it's little dreamy me. Someone to take my hand, to be a team with me. So nice, that would be so nice. If one day I find someone who will take my hand and samba through life with me. Someone to cling to me, stay with me right or wrong. Someone to sing to me, some little
little sound of song. Someone to take my heart, then give his heart to me. Someone who's ready to give love a start with me. Oh yeah, that would be so nice. Should it be you and me? I can see it would be nice.
Yes, and it has that sort of organ sort of break in the middle. It suddenly makes you think you're at Butlin's in the Irvine Ballroom, filling in between the knobbly knees competition and the glamorous granny. So maybe that appeals as well.
Summer Samba, so nice, sung by Astrud Gilberto. So you work hard at your scripts, Paul, and being funny is hard work. How easy was it then to turn your talent to improvisation, which is what was required of you with Channel 4's Whose Line Is It Anyways?
Well, I started doing it around about 1985. There was a guy called Mike Myers who went on to do Wayne's World, that big film years ago. He was over here at the time doing a double act with Neil Mullarkey, and he was Canadian, and there was also Kit Hollaback who was working over here, who was American. And there's in the States, there's a long tradition of improv clubs. Wherever you go to any of the big cities, they've all got them. And he thought, well, there's not one here, so I was doing a show with Kit, and Neil was doing a show with Mike in Edinburgh, and so we got together, and they sort of explained what it was, and I thought, well, this is witchcraft, this can't be done. But then gradually, after a while of doing it regularly, and just, you know, going to a couple of classes that Kit was holding at the time, and just getting experience at it, you realise that all you're really doing is just, you're talking off the top of your head, and it's, you know, it's like a conversation, except that it's got to be funny and stuff.
We should explain, for anybody who hasn't seen Whose Line Is It Anyway, that it's a programme which you're required to act and be funny about any subject or anybody.
And sometimes
sometimes these things are suggested at random by the audience, so you never do know. You can't possibly have any warning.
No, you have no idea.
It takes a lot of nerve, though, doesn't it? Is that what it needs? Sheer guts?
No, not, it's more than sheer guts, because General Patton would be doing it then, wouldn't he? You need, again, that confidence at the core of it all, and if the first thing you say isn't funny, you say the second thing. If that's not funny, then let the other person on stage do a bit of talking, and then you'll come in with something. The thing is never to sort of think, right, I've got to be funny now, I've got to be funny, it's my chance, here it comes, oh, I didn't say something funny, oh, you know, and then you just relax into it, and it will happen.
Record number six.
Record number six. Well, this is a desert island. I thought I should have some sort of something about water in there somewhere. And I've always liked this particular song. It's by the Beach Boys, Surf's Up. It's one of Brian Wilson's compositions round about the time he was going off his trolley, really. But it's a beautifully sung, beautifully written song, I think.
Surf's up. Come about heart and join the young and often spring you gave. I heard the word wonderful thing, a children's song.
The Beach Boys and Surf's Up. So is it the determined, optimistic Paul Merton who's going to this desert island, or is it the one who knows that, there's a black hole down there if he's not careful?
I don't know how I would survive on this, really, because I'm essentially a very non-practical person. I couldn't put up a bookshelf, not that I would need to do that on a desert island, but I wouldn't, a rude hut or anything like that would be totally beyond me, really, because I'm useless at all that kind of the carpentry, all that kind of thing.
Can't even open a coffee flask.
No, exactly.
But psychologically, how would you cope?
I don't know. It would be very lonely. And I've spent, a number of years living in bedsits and being on my own and stuff like that. But it's not an activity that I particularly enjoy. So, no, I don't think I'd get on particularly well.
You're also, by all accounts, an old romantic at heart.
Mm.
You got married fairly recently.
Yes, within the last 18 months we did. Yes, we got married. It seemed like a good idea.
Tell me about the proposal.
The proposal. Well, I was trying to think of a romantic part of London, and the statue of Eros in Piccadilly Circus was the most romantic place I could think of. So I got down on one knee in the middle of Piccadilly Circus with all these homeless people and police walking around and various drunks and stuff, and proposed marriage, you know. And Caroline gave it a very long pause and milked the moment and then said yes, so it was fine.
She's an actress.
Yeah, yeah. She's allowed to do that.
Caroline Quinton. And is she critical of your appearances? Do you have professional habits that she doesn't like apart from personal ones?
She's very good. I mean, yeah, she is. I mean, she'll say things about... She'd never sort of say, oh, that was wonderful if it wasn't, you know, and she'll say that was very good if it was.
But most important of all, do you make each other laugh?
Oh, yes, I think, but that's essential in any kind of relationship, really, isn't it? But then I don't want to paint a picture where, as soon as I go home, we lock the front door and laugh uproariously till the next morning and then go out again. I mean, you know, it's ups and downs and things.
Record number 7.
Monsters and Angels by Voice of the Beehive, a sort of... two American sisters sort of front the group, and the reason why I chose this because it was one of those moments in life where suddenly I got carried away with something. I'd done the Wogan show in 1987 before the broken leg business, and I was very full of myself the next day, and I was comparing a music event, and I was just chatting to the drummer of this group, Voice of the Beehive, who were on, and I was sort of saying, well, yes, I've just... he asked me some innocuous question, and I immediately turned it around to the fact that I'd been on Wogan the night before. And he said, he sort of listened to it all. He said, I had to do some television for a group I was in. And I sort of rather loftily said, well, who was that? And he said, Madness. And of course, it was a drummer for Madness who played this group. And I just thought, that's what I've just done is my ego has got temporarily out of control. And I'm speaking to this guy from Madness who must have done 1,000 television shows all over Europe in the last 10 years. And here I am, talking about being on Wogan or something, you know. I went out and sought out the record after I'd met them, and it just sort of reminds me just of the other side of being in control of it, when suddenly you think you're better or greater than you actually are.
Monsters and Angels by Voice of the Beehive. It does seem, Paul, as if you can do no wrong at the moment. I mean, you've got another series of your own on 4. You,
yes.
Have I Got News for You is coming up again on 2.
Yeah.
You've just written a book. Your own
yes.
show is touring the country. Do you worry that the bubble's going to burst?
No, I don't see it as a bubble, really, because I don't think it's like a manufactured thing. I mean, Have I Got News for You is a success not because I'm on it, but because of the whole nature of things that are going on in that show. There are a number of successful elements of which I'm one, I suppose.
What do your mum and dad think of it all? Are they bemused by your success, or did they always know you'd get there in the end?
Oh, I think they were very bemused at the beginning, you know. But it's funny, it's like the power of television. The very first time I was on television, that's when they stopped leaving the situation vacant newspaper lying around with a little ring around a certain job, you know, just casually on the table for me to glance at. And suddenly it was great, you know. I could do no wrong then, you know. And you know how it is, you do one television thing and then nothing for a while. But they were of the idea that once you've done it once, then you're on next week automatically because you've joined the band of people who are on television. No, they thought it was and think it's great, I'm sure.
And you think it's great? I mean, you're enjoying it?
Oh, yes, yeah. I treat it as a job, and when I go home, that's try and sort of leave it there, you know. But, no, it's what I've always wanted to do, and it's fun.
Last record
is a song by the Kinks. I've always been a fan of the Kinks, but this is a sort of rather obscure one of theirs. It's a song, I think, that Ray Davies wrote about an uncle who had gone to Australia, who sort of was this man that he, you know, had a great deal of affection for. And it's a kind of way of, in the song, expressing that affection. And it's about sort of, I don't know, being working class and thinking that life's passed you by and you never achieve what you wanted to achieve, or you were locked into a job very early on which you couldn't leave because children came along, all that kind of thing. And that's kind of my background, really, which is probably what I would have done if I hadn't have got on stage at the Comedy Store, or if it hadn't have worked and it wasn't funny and I was useless at it. It's the kind of thing that I would have done, you know. So I suppose it's there for that reason. Also, I like it. It's a good tune.
By the Kinks, if you could only take one of those eight records?
I think I would have to I'd have to take the Kronos Quartet one, I think, because it's one of the few ones there that's absolutely uplifting, and, you know, the other ones sometimes have sad memories attached to a couple of them, and I think, yeah, I'd probably take that one, you know, just as a kind of cheery sort of, you know, get up and catch a turtle kind of music.
What about your book?
I think the book I would take would be a biography of Buster Keaton, by a man called Rudy Blesch, a sort of American author from the sort of mid-60s. And I got very, very fond of Buster Keaton at one point, and I read this book several times, and I suppose it, a lot of my views of what comedy could be and should be was sort of formed by that book. And so I'll take that one, I think.
And your luxury?
I'd have a bed, please, I think, because there's no point in me making one, you know, it wouldn't last the night.
Big, small sheets and blankets.
I think blankets, if there's a sort of cold snap or whatever, you know, and I think, yes, a bit of room would be very nice, and a soft mattress that wouldn't need turning out often.
Paul Merton, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.